Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is committed to bringing you the stories and perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. From the peace activists demanding an end to war, to indigenous leaders fighting to stop fossil fuel extraction and save the planet. Our independent reporting is only possible because we're funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate crisis. We count on your generous support to keep Democracy Now! Going. Please make your donation of $5, $10, or more at democracynow.org. Every dollar counts. Thank you so much. We're counting on you. Stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The Russian invasion in Ukraine is amplifying and accelerating all these factors. Climate change, COVID-19, and inequality. It threatens to tip tens of millions of people over the edge into food insecurity, followed by malnutrition, mass hunger, and famine in a crisis that could last for years.
As the United Nations warns again about the devastating global impact of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we'll look at why talks to end the war appear to have collapsed. We'll speak to New School professor Nina Khrushcheva, the great-granddaughter of former Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. Then to Buffalo, where an 18-year-old white supremacist shot dead 10 people at a grocery store in the heart of the black community. We'll speak with the head of Brady, one of the oldest gun violence groups in the U.S. And Chile is rewriting its constitution to replace the one created under the U.S.-backed dictator Augusto Pinochet. A new draft constitution has just been released.
This text materializes a new way of treating one another, a new way of understanding life in our country, where everyone can feel protected.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House of Representatives has approved a bill aimed at combating domestic terrorism following last weekend's attack by a white supremacist who killed 10 black people in a Buffalo supermarket. The Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act passed on a vote of 222-203 Wednesday with the support of just one Republican lawmaker. It calls for the creation of a domestic terrorism offices within the Departments of Justice and Homeland Security. Meanwhile, New York State is launching an investigation into social media platforms used by the Buffalo shooting suspect. Governor Kathy Hochul announced the investigation Wednesday.
Today, I'm announcing a referral to the Attorney General's office to investigate the social media platforms that broadcast this horrific attack, that promote and elevate hate speech, and legitimize the replacement theory in the mind of an 18-year-old, a radicalized 18-year-old.
Governor Hochul also announced a series of steps to tighten New York's gun laws. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with Chris Brown, head of Brady, one of the oldest gun violence groups in the U.S. In Ukraine, the International Committee of the Red Cross has begun registering hundreds of Ukrainian fighters as prisoners of war after they surrendered in Mariupol. Russia now says over 1,700 Ukrainians have surrendered since May 16th after a weeks-long standoff at the Azovstal steel plant. Russia's threatened to hold war crimes trials for some of the captured soldiers. Meanwhile, a 21-year-old Russian soldier has pleaded guilty in the first war crimes trial conducted by Ukraine since the start of the invasion. The soldier admitted to shooting dead a 62-year-old Ukrainian man in the region of Sumy. For the first time in over a year, the United States has an ambassador to Ukraine. On Wednesday, the Senate confirmed Bridget Brink by unanimous voice vote without a formal roll call. The post has been vacant since then-President Trump forced Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch out of the role in 2019 as Trump sought to pressure Ukraine's government into providing dirt on Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden. Meanwhile, the Kremlin said Wednesday it would expel 85 embassy staff from French, Italian and Spanish diplomatic missions after the three countries expelled hundreds of Russian diplomats. Russia has also closed the Moscow bureau of the Canadian broadcaster CBC and stripped its journalists of their visas and accreditation. A Russian foreign ministry spokesperson said the decision came after Canada's telecommunications regulator stopped distributing two Kremlin-sponsored channels.
A recent example was the ban imposed by the Canadian authorities on Russian TV channels Russia Today and Russia Today France from broadcasting in the country. We said that we would respond symmetrically, in a similar way, however you like to call it, adequately. And now we are responding.
The U.S. Air Force says it carried out a successful test of a new type of hypersonic missile over the weekend. The Pentagon says a B-52 bomber off the coast of Southern California successfully test-fired an air-launched rapid response weapon that reached five times the speed of sound. The test of the nuclear-capable missile follows similar tests by China. And after Russian President Vladimir Putin said he's deployed hypersonic missiles during Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Finland and Sweden have agreed to a joint purchase of new weapons and ammunition. The arms deal was announced Wednesday as the two nations formally submitted their applications to join the NATO military alliance. The deal would include the purchase of anti-tank weapons from the Swedish weapons maker Saab. President Biden's meeting in Washington today with leaders of Finland and Sweden in a show of support for their applications to join NATO. Later today, Biden departs on a six-day trip to Asia, where he's scheduled to meet with leaders of South Korea, Japan, India, and Australia. Biden's trip comes amidst increased naval tensions with China, as analysts say North Korea is preparing an underground nuclear weapons test in the coming days, which will be the first such test since 2017. Israel's military has decided not to open a criminal investigation into the killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. That's according to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Witnesses and fellow journalists say the Palestinian-American journalist was killed by an Israeli soldier while reporting on an Israeli military raid in Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Abu Akleh's family has told Al Jazeera that they will not be surprised if Israel fails to investigate her killing. The Centers for Disease Control's warning U.S. residents to consider wearing masks in indoor settings amidst a new surge of infections caused by mutant forms of the Omicron coronavirus variant. The average number of confirmed daily coronavirus infections across the U.S. has topped 100,000 for the first time since February, and that total fails to account for cases that go unreported or undetected by at-home tests. New York City raised its COVID alert level to high Wednesday, even as Mayor Eric Adams rejected calls to impose mask mandates and other public health measures.
Variants are going to come. If every variant that comes, we move into shutdown thoughts, we move in through panicking, we're not going to function as a city.
On Wednesday, Health and Human Services Secretary Becerra said he tested positive for coronavirus during a trip to Germany and is isolating in Berlin with mild symptoms. Meanwhile, President Biden's daughter, Ashley Biden, has tested positive for COVID, will cancel plans to join First Lady Jill Biden on a trip to Central and South America. The Kansas Supreme Court has upheld a Republican-created congressional voting map rejected by voting rights groups as the result of partisan and racial gerrymandering. Kansas's new map lowers the re-election chances of Democratic Representative Sharice Davids, who made history in 2018 by becoming one of the first two Native Americans elected to Congress. In Wisconsin, two Democrats who served as Electoral College delegates have filed a first-of-its-kind lawsuit against a slate of fake electors put forward by allies of Donald Trump in a bid to overturn Joe Biden's 2020 victory. President Biden's invoked the Defense Production Act in order to address the nationwide baby formula shortage and hopes that the Korean War-era law will boost the domestic manufacturing of formula. Biden's decision to invoke the DPA underscores the severity of the shortage, which has left store shelves bare and many parents desperate to feed their infants.
The Defense Production Act gives the government the ability to require suppliers to direct needed resources to infant formula manufacturers before any other customer who may have ordered that good. And I'm also announcing Operation Fly Formula. That's to be able to speed up the import of infant formula and start getting more formula in stores as soon as possible.
To see our interview with David Dayen, you can go to democracynow.org on monopolies. On Wednesday, the House passed a $28 million emergency funding bill for the Food and Drug Administration in order to address the formula crisis. Here in New York, a 31-year-old Rikers Island prisoner has died of what officials at the jail said was a drug overdose. Mary Yehuda was discovered in medical distress in a women's unit at Rikers Island Tuesday. She died early Wednesday in a nearby hospital in Queens. Yehuda is the fifth Rikers prisoner to die this year, the 21st since the start of 2021. Last month, the U.S. Justice Department said it might take control of the Rikers Island jail complex, citing an extraordinary level of violence and disorder at the jails. In Minnesota, former Minneapolis police officer Thomas Lane has pleaded guilty to a charge of second-degree manslaughter over his role in the murder of George Floyd 2 years ago. Video of the 2020 killing shows Lane helped to restrain Floyd as then-officer Derek Chauvin pressed his knee into Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes, killing him. Lane faces a suggested sentence of 36 months in prison. Two other former officers, Tu Tao and J. Alexander King, still face charges of aiding and abetting George Floyd's murder at a trial scheduled in a state court next month. In a new landmark labor agreement, the U.S. Soccer Federation will be paying members of its women's and men's teams equally. The deal stipulates soccer players will receive the same pay when competing in international matches, and in an historic provision, dictates U.S. Soccer will address the gender disparity in the amount of prize money awarded by soccer's governing body, FIFA, by pooling the prizes and redistributing them equally across members of both teams. And as the Supreme Court appears poised to strike down Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion across the U.S., Democratic Congressmember Lucy McMath made an emotional appeal Wednesday, highlighting how attacks on abortion rights can impact treatments available to patients who, like her, have experiences with miscarriage and stillbirth. McMath spoke at a meeting of the House Judiciary Committee.
After which failed pregnancy should I have been imprisoned? Would it have been after the first miscarriage? After doctors used what would be an illegal drug to abort the lost fetus? Would you have put me in jail after the second miscarriage? Perhaps that would have been the time. Forced to reflect in confinement at the guilt I felt, the guilt that so many women feel after losing their pregnancies. Or would you have put me behind bars after my stillbirth? After I was forced to carry a dead fetus for weeks, after asking God if I was ever going to be able to raise a child, and I asked because the same medicine used to treat my failed pregnancies is the same medicine states like Texas would make illegal.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The New York Times is reporting talks to end the war in Ukraine have collapsed, with Russian and Ukrainian negotiators further apart from an agreement than at any other point during the war. Russia claims Ukraine still has not responded to a draft peace agreement it submitted April 15th. The Times reports Ukraine has been bolstered by a flood of weapons from the United States and its allies. The U.S. Senate is expected to vote today to approve an additional $40 billion in military and economic aid to Ukraine. Meanwhile, leaders of France, Germany, and Italy are publicly calling for negotiations to end the war. On Friday, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz wrote on Twitter, "There must be a ceasefire in Ukraine as quickly as possible," he made the comment after a call with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Last week, French President Emmanuel Macron told the European Parliament Europe's duty should be to achieve a ceasefire, not wage war with Russia. Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi also braced the pushing for negotiations to reach a ceasefire. With the war in Ukraine now in its 85th day, we turn to Nina Khrushcheva, professor of international affairs at the New School, co-author of In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. She's also the great-granddaughter of the former Soviet premier Nikita Khrushchev. Her recent piece in Foreign Affairs is headlined "The Coup in the Kremlin." Professor Khrushcheva, if you could start off by commenting on some European Western allies like Germany, France and Italy, saying that there should be a negotiated settlement now. Yet we see at this point, it looks like the talks between Ukraine and Russia have collapsed. Can you talk about what's happened and what you think needs to happen to bring this to a close?
Thank you, Amy, very much. Well, Germany has a bit of a kind of difficult road in trying to balance between Russia and Ukraine to a degree, because Olaf Scholz just recently said that Putin is not ready for negotiations and Ukraine is not going to agree to a forced settlement. So Germany, on one hand, does want to or does advocate for negotiated settlement. On the other hand, it depends. It almost seems like it depends who Olaf Scholz talked to the last moment. I think Italy has come up with an interesting, I think it was five articles proposal of how you can negotiate. And it is possible, what I'm hearing at least today from Moscow, that Moscow is seriously looking into it. It's not clear whether they're going to accept it. It's not clear whether the negotiations will rise up again, because for now, it seems to me that both sides appear to want to have more military victories or small victories as they are. And they think that for now, for example, Russians feel that they can take a little bit more of Ukrainian territory, and Ukrainians feel that they can, for example, they were just the Ukrainians just expelled the Russian forces from the remaining Russian forces from the city of Kharkiv. So the Ukrainians feel that it's possible that they can, in fact, free out some of the Ukrainian territory already taken by the Russians. So what we know from wars from time immemorial is that when there is a decision to keep on with taking territory, freeing territory, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to get to actual negotiations because military wins or military desire to win more territory wins.
Nina, could you respond to those who say, let's talk about the role of the U.S. In pushing for negotiations, first of all, if the U.S. has been doing that, and second of all, respond to those who say that U.S. policy now has completely shifted, whereas initially it was about defending Ukraine, it's now about defeating Russia. Do you agree with that? And if so, what kind of defeat? What would defeat look like for Russia?
Well, thank you. I actually don't think it's shifted. I think it was pretty obvious from the beginning that the United States was, it didn't expect Russia to be doing so badly or the war going so slowly, in a sense, and Putin having less victories than initially expected. Remember the calculation on the American side that Kiev could be taken by the Russians in 3 days. I mean, you know, it hasn't been taken at all so far and doesn't seem to be in the Russian plans whatsoever. But I think that the regime change, in a sense, was American idea right from the beginning. And that's what the sanctions were, the consorted and massive sanctions, the Russians call it the economic weapons of mass destruction, have been all about kind of this idea that the Russians would get so traumatized that they would just get to the streets and sweep Putin away, or the oligarchs would get very upset because the yachts are taken away and then and just go and have a coup. So I don't know if the United States position has changed. It probably became more vocal the more they talk to Ukrainians. And also, I mean, Ukrainians have shown, not that it was a surprise to me, I must say, but Ukrainians have shown incredible resilience. And so when the negotiations were seemingly doing okay, the Russians withdrew from the areas of Kiev. And that was, you know, for the Russians, they say it was the idea that they're just going to help negotiations. But it was taken by the Ukrainian side, and the American side is the Russian defeat, and then the more weapons went into Ukraine. So I think the United States, it doesn't seem to be interested, or at least I haven't seen any interest in, fact, negotiated position, because they do think Ukraine can win or should win. But also, as one of the anchors, American anchors, TV anchors, told me, is that how do we get rid of Putin? And my response was, we may not, because it's not a Hollywood movie. I mean, you know, not everything ends with a Marvel character victory. But it does seem that the United States thinks that Ukraine should be supported in its war effort, not its negotiation effort, until the very end, because the victories of Ukraine, or not defeats of Ukraine, are much greater than than originally was expected.
And Nina, you mentioned now the sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on Russia, and what possibility they had to weaken Putin's position. You are in regular touch with people in Russia. What are the effects of these sanctions on ordinary people, and what effect have they had on the regime?
Well, the regime has couched the sanctions well enough. I mean, clearly there's not enough, or there is no Western products whatsoever. I mean, I was told, I haven't been in Moscow since then, but I was told there's just gaping holes in all this luxury and non-luxury Western stores all over, you know, in Moscow and all over other Russian cities. So that's not a pretty picture. And it does seem to be very upsetting. It's very upsetting for the Russians. You know, McDonald's, the symbol of kind of Russian global, Russia joining the global American formula, the McDonald's shop. McDonald's restaurant on Pushkin Square in the center of Moscow just got closed. But what Russians were able to do, and I don't know how, because it's not really, it's only 3 months. It hasn't been enough time to really see the consequences. But that McDonald's now is just going to have a different name, and they say 90% of what McDonald's was doing is going to be done there. So the symbol of McDonald's is gone, but the products may remain and still seem to be remaining. But I think what it also does for the Russians is that they get very angry at the West. They're angry at Putin for what he put them into. But when the West closed, I mean, it's a summarily punishment, summary punishment of all Russians, whether they support the war, and a lot of them do not support the war. And that makes them very angry in the West and very upset at the West, because they feel like they're completely squeezed between the rock and the hard place. They have no place to go. They have no visas. I mean, they're given no consideration when they try to flee abroad. And a lot of them who did flee abroad at the beginning of the war in February and March now have to come back because they can't open bank accounts and so on and so forth. So I think that should be, in fact, something that U.S. and other Western countries should look into, is that how to actually bolster civil society that is remaining in Russia rather than completely killing whatever is left.
Professor Nina Khrushcheva, you wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs called The Coup in the Kremlin, How Putin and the Security Services Captured the Russian State. Why don't you lay that out for us, and how you think it shapes Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
Well, thank you. I mean, it's a really long piece. Well, I mean, Putin, as we know, was a KGB lieutenant colonel when he took over the position first of the prime minister in 1999 and then became president of Russia in 2000. So it was in many ways a KGB coup. And I start my piece with him joking, speaking to the security forces for their kind of unofficial and then became official holiday on December 20th, that the order, that the security forces order of infiltrating the highest echelons of political power in Russia is now achieved. So that was a joke, but it was not a joke, because a lot of people who oversaw or have been overseeing, you know, oil and gas industry and the Cosmos industry and so on and so forth, the bank industry, they were Putin's friends and colleagues, former friends and colleagues from KGB. But my argument is that what happened on February 24th is that was as I call it, an FSB on FSB coup, because before, even if the KGB people, and I call KGB summarily security forces people, were in charge, it was also kind of a handpick operation. You can push more, you can push back, but they were also understanding that, you know, Russia needs security, and it's a very, should be very strong security apparatus, but it also should be part of the world. And therefore, it wasn't really summarily being suppressed in any in all forms. But in February 24th, some security officials, or many security officials, may not be ready. They were not. We know that they were not ready for that. It was Putin's decision, and yet the collective security apparatus took it as a sign that now oppression in Russia is their primary consideration, because Russia is the state that needs to withstand the demands of the West, to withstand the attacks of the West, the way it is being presented. And so the functional autocracy that was there until February 24th now has been replaced through this absolutely blind, faceless security bureaucracies. And that's what this war in Ukraine, in addition to everything else, is all about. And so one of the things that is interesting, that, you know, there's expectations that, well, if Putin is gone, it's going to get better. Well, it may get less toxic. I don't think it's going to get better, because once security is in charge of Russia, we've seen it over centuries of history, in charge of Russia, it's not giving its power that easily. So Russia may be less toxic to the world, but it'd certainly be infinitely more oppressive within Russia.
Nina, could you say, you just said that the decision to invade Ukraine was Putin's decision. On what grounds did he make this decision? Because many have pointed out that this was, of course, it's catastrophic for Ukraine, but also catastrophic for Russia. What kind of intelligence were these security officials giving him that allowed him to make this decision, which appears to have gone, the invasion seems to have gone quite differently from how they might have imagined?
Absolutely. And that's, I mean, I wrote about it in the piece, but I also wrote about it in previous pieces that I do column for Project Syndicate, sort of explaining this, because Putin, as I said, a KGB man, so that was run like a clandestine operation, essentially. So only few people knew what was going on. In fact, the army itself didn't know when it's going to go, whether it's going to go full way into Ukraine or just the eastern parts of it. But also, I mean, it is absolute power corrupts absolutely. Putin has been on top of the state for 22 years. They've been, security forces that were feeding him information about Ukraine and its Nazi president or Western-controlled government, and how ordinary Ukrainians are suffering from that kind of the Nazi type oppression, because nobody really in the right mind believed that that Putin would go and do this, because that really is, as you said, I mean, not only destroyed Ukraine, it also completely, and Ukraine will rebuild and Ukraine will be better than ever, but Russia is just destroyed for decades, if not for centuries to come, because nobody is going to believe us that we are in fact going to become a normal country one day. And so that intelligence that was fed to him is the intelligence he wanted to hear. That is, Ukraine is just ready to fold and embrace the Russia as the leader of the Pan-Slavic state that somehow Putin imagined he would put together. And that is, I mean, I think it's not enough time has passed, but I think from, you know, when there is more time passed, it would be one of the most incredible research in history, how on earth this complete disinformation, misinformation resulted in this catastrophic decision for not just for Ukraine, not just for Russia, but also for the world at large.
Mm-hmm. And Nina, could you talk a little bit about the response within Russia, to the extent that you're aware of it, not among the people so much as among officials? Earlier this week, there was a video that was widely circulated of a former Russian colonel who appear to be critical of perceptions of the war in Russia and among the security establishment. This is a Tleb.
First, I should say you should not take information on sedatives. Sometimes you hear reports of a moral psychological breakdown in the Ukrainian armed forces, that their mood is allegedly close to a crisis. To put it mildly, this is not true. The situation for us will clearly get worse. The biggest problem with our military and political situation is that we are in total geopolitical isolation, and the whole world is against us, even if we don't want to admit it.
So, Nina, could you respond to that, especially given the fact that he was speaking on state television, and then he appeared again a couple of days later, just on Wednesday, and seemed to express a very, very different opinion. And so there's been speculation that he was warned not to speak out in this fashion.
Absolutely. He was good for him. He absolutely was warned not to speak out in this fashion and talk about the Russian isolation, because what we hear from the officials who originally on February 21st, when Putin announced that Russia would recognize the independence of Donetsk and Luhansk republics, his Security Council seemed to be, I think we spoke about it on this program, seemed to be in a complete shock about it. But, you know, then they soon enough kind of settled down, figured it out, where some were warned, some were threatened. Some just didn't have any other place to go, in a sense. Suddenly, whatever he's saying is now considered treason. And those officials who originally were in shock now are the ones saying that, you know, if you talk negatively about the Russian, as they call it, special military operation, or talk about the Russian forces, the military forces that are not advancing as fast as they should, that amounts to treason. Those who left the country and critical, that amounts to treason, and so on and so forth. So with the officials, there is some, I mean, clearly there is a inside dissent, but very rarely you can hear it publicly. And in fact, more and more so, we hear from those officials with absolute terror in their eyes how they just now stand behind Russia, and motherland is something that is against the West and the United States. Just now, the iconic character, Yuri Shevchuk, who was the icon of Russian hard rock, just had a concert in which, and before that, he spoke what motherland in fact means to him, and spoke against the war. What happened after the concert? He was immediately detained. He was immediately interrogated, and now there is a lawsuit against him, and he is the icon of the Russian rock. So basically, it is a martial law that is not being announced as a martial law, but it affects everybody. It affects people who try to protest and can't because they immediately detained the celebrities and, of course, the officials and the oligarchs. That's why from the oligarchs, I think only three, and I write about it in my foreign affairs article, only three have actually spoken mildly or forcefully against the war, and the rest are silent and accepting. That's the KGB force.
Professor Khrushchev, you've studied Putin. Your book is In Putin's Footsteps. What about the exposure of his family? It's so rare to learn about, for example, the sanctioning of his two daughters, of his longtime girlfriend. What does this do to him?
Nothing.
So let me ask you another question then. At the end of your book, since we have so little time, you talk about Kremlin officials saying that this will end the way the Soviet Union pulled out of Afghanistan in the late 80s. What does that look like?
Well, that looks like they withdrew from Afghanistan after 10 years of a horrible war in 89. with tail between their legs, completely humiliated. And as we remember, in 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed. And so that's what those officials who don't speak publicly, but sometimes speak to people like me, say they envision this regime will fall. What they don't know is when that happens.
And finally, before we end, I wanted to play for you a comment made by former President George W. Bush. It was Wednesday. He spoke at his presidential center in Dallas about the invasion of Ukraine, but the speech took an unexpected turn.
The result is an absence of checks and balances in Russia and the decision of one man to launch a wholly unjustified and brutal invasion of Iraq. I mean, of Ukraine. Iraq, too. Anyway. 75.
That's video of Bush's comments. They've gone viral. The former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner responded tweeting, George W. Bush had just admitted to being a war criminal of the likes of Vladimir Putin, then laughed. Sickening. Professor Khrushcheva, your response?
Well, I agree. And actually, the Russians have been playing that clip and you know, with the comments, look who is talking. So that's what their response is that, you know, you are lecturing us on our unjust war and look what you have done all around the world. And I think, you know, I go back, as I always do, to my former mentor, George Kennan, who wrote an article in Foreign Affairs in 1995, calling it On American Principles. And so, you know, when America does things like it did in Iraq, then people like Kim Jong-un, people like Putin would go in and say, well, America can do it. Why can't we?
Nina Khrushcheva, professor of international affairs, New School, co-author of In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones, great-granddaughter of former Soviet premier Nikita Khrushchev. We'll link to your piece in Foreign Affairs, headlined The Coup in the Kremlin. Next up, we speak to the head of BRADY, one of the oldest gun violence prevention groups in the U.S., about the status of gun control after the racist massacre in Buffalo Saturday. Stay with us.
The sun has set, the day is done. We lay to rest another one. A mother cries for her only son, broken hearted. We'll say a prayer or start a fight. To do tonight, 'cause either way we end up right back where we started. No, we can't just look away. No, we can't just stay the same.
If We Keep Doing Nothing by Chris Allen. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Saturday's racist massacre in Buffalo, New York, was the 198th mass shooting of this year. A mass shooting is often defined as when four or more people are shot or killed. The 18-year-old white gunman killed 10 people, all of them black, at a supermarket in the heart of Buffalo's black community. Investigators say Peyton Gendron posted online about the racist ideology that drove his attack and created a private chat room on Discord about 30 minutes beforehand, sharing his plans with others. Gendron also wrote online about how he legally bought, at a local gun store, the Bushmaster XM15 semi-automatic rifle used in the attack, then illegally modified the gun to use a high-capacity magazine. He also had a shotgun in his car and planned to use a rifle, he says, his father bought him for Christmas in 2020. Law enforcement officials say Gendron was taken to an emergency room for a mental health evaluation last year after he turned in a high school project about murder-suicide. He waited for 15 hours for the evaluation. It took 15 minutes. He was not involuntarily committed. The incident did not generate a red flag to prevent him from legally accessing deadly firearms. In response to the attack, the House of Representatives approved the Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act Wednesday with the support of just one Republican lawmaker. It calls for the creation of domestic terrorism offices within the Departments of Justice and Homeland Security. More than half of the terrorist incidents in the United States where people have died over the last 10 years have been committed by right-wing white supremacist extremists. Meanwhile, New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced an investigation into social media platforms Gendron used. For more, we're joined by Chris Brown, president of Brady, one of the oldest gun violence prevention groups in the United States. Chris, welcome back to Democracy Now! It seems like there's actually hardly a discussion right now about gun control, about laws passed to prevent. I mean, in the past, you could have a child, you could have a teenager very angry, but they don't have access to these high-capacity weapons. Now they do all over this country. What are you demanding happen?
We have demanded that the federal government, Congress, pass an assault weapons ban. Brady was responsible, Jim and Sarah Brady, a year after passing the Background Check Act in 1993. Jim and Sarah saw that there was a proliferation of mass shootings with assault weapons at that time and enacted in 1994 an assault weapons ban. And that was in effect, unfortunately, Amy, just for a decade, because at the very last minute in the Senate, a provision was included in that law that sunset that law after a decade. And so it expired, it lapsed, not because it wasn't working. All of the research shows that for the decade that that federal assault weapon ban was in effect, you saw a reduction in the use of those kinds of weapons in any kind of mass killing. And in fact, the states that have assault weapons ban also see those kinds of reductions. So we know these kinds of laws work. Our demand is that we renew an assault weapons ban at the federal level, and also that we restrict production of high-capacity magazines or large-capacity magazines. In this particular instance, what happens in Buffalo is that the shooter went out of the state of New York to purchase, apparently, exactly that, a large-capacity magazine, and then modified the firearm that he had to take that large capacity magazine. We see this time and time and time again, Amy, with respect to these shooters and these shootings, the use of a large capacity magazine, because most of these guns have magazines that just hold 10 rounds. Large capacity magazines are those magazines that hold more, in some cases, 100 rounds. Why is that important? Because time is against you if you are carrying out these kinds of acts. The time it takes to stop and reload and put a new magazine on is the time to in which you could be tackled, in which you yourself could be shot. And the shooter in his manifesto notes he uses exactly these kinds of weapons for those kinds of purposes. So it's obvious what we need to do. Our frustration is actually right now with the United States Senate, because we're passing these kinds of bills. We have a background check bill pending for the second term of Congress in a row in the United States Senate. And there it sits. We have enough votes right now. We've done the counts to know that we could pass a background check bill in the United States Senate, but for the filibuster. It's the same filibuster that is stopping the progress around the Voting Rights Act, around a variety of other important priorities of President Biden. And so Brady also has loudly and will continue to proclaim that the filibuster is killing us. The reason we say that is, let's think about what this means for our democracy. We understand that the issue of guns, for no good reason, has become polarized and politicized in America, but Americans agree on the solutions. 90% plus of Americans across this country want
the Brady Law to be expanded, the bill that's sitting in the Senate, over a simple majority. Last poll I saw was 67% of Americans want an assault weapons ban. Why aren't we getting these things through? Because of certain arcane laws or rules, not even a law, like the filibuster, that stops the debate on laws like this that 9 out of 10 Americans want, like the Brady Law, because the filibuster demands 60 votes for cloture for any of these things to come forward. So these things are connected, to be honest. Our issue of gun violence prevention is connected deeply with issues related to our democracy. And that's why we're taking those on too, and really want all Americans to understand, if you want this change, we need to end the filibuster. We have done everything we can as an organization, activism, showing up, voting, getting the House of Representatives to pass these kinds of bills. We need to end the filibuster now if we want the next step to happen, which is in the enactment of these laws. And that could happen tomorrow. It could happen tomorrow because we have the votes on background checks, which would be an important first step if we end the filibuster.
Chris, can you talk about whether Biden should take executive action on this, given the obstacles in Congress?
Absolutely. Yes, he should, and he has. I will say, I have a huge amount of respect for the president. I know, having talked to him, he is deeply, deeply frustrated and upset by the continuation of gun violence in this country. And that's why he campaigned on tackling this issue. He hoped, like all Americans, that Congress would do its job, but its failure to do that has not stopped him from issuing a series of executive actions, strengthening the enforcement ability of the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, to regulate the sale of guns in this country, which is an essential first step in strengthening the Brady Law, putting significant increases in his budget to help fund things like effective and efficient background checks across the country, effective and efficient powers of the ATF to shut down and reform the 5% of gun dealers that are responsible for the 90% of crime guns across the country, which is driving homicide rates everywhere, including in places like New York, which has very strong gun laws, but has a huge amount of guns coming in sold lawfully, but to traffickers who then use them to sell them in places like New York. And he also has focused on the issue of ghost guns. So, so important. He's banned ghost guns. We worked with the administration for over a year for putting those forward. He needs to continue those efforts, though, looking at the problem as a comprehensive problem that touches so many Americans. We lose 45,000 Americans a year to gun violence. That's 2020 numbers, Amy. That's the highest rate in 25 years of gun deaths, surpassing auto fatalities as the number one killer of Americans today, American youth. We need to fix this. And what we have to do, what I'd like to see the president do, is actually talk much more frequently about the fact that this is a public health epidemic, and we need to tackle it like that. So while he has moved a lot of executive actions forward that really focus on DOJ, Department of Justice, I would like to see him move more executive actions forward that focus on the public health angle of this and actually really incent agencies through HHS, Health and Human Services, Medicaid and Medicare, CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and other federal agencies to look at this comprehensively and think through how we can prevent gun violence in this country. Why is that important? Because for 20 years...
We have 30 seconds.
The CDC was prohibited from even researching gun violence. So we want this president to come forward and call it what it is. This is a public health epidemic. Let's treat it like we did automobile fatalities in the 50s. Have a comprehensive response. And the thing is, it's preventable. If we do that, I'm confident that we can save lives. And I think that's an America all of us need to have. It's one that's worthy of how great we say we are.
Chris Brown, I want to thank you for being with us. President of Brady, one of the oldest gun violence prevention groups in the United States. Of course, an issue we will continue to cover. Next up, we go to Chile. Stay with us.
Un cabro de 17 años recogiendo cartón con su hermana menor en
Santiago.
Una señora recogiendo basura mientras el neoburgués le paga su nana aquí en
Santiago.
Ya que es un sistema de dinerito, dineral, yeah, que no tiene, tiene que luchar aquí en
Santiago.
Y esto pasa, 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 y esto pasa en todo.
By the Chilean band New and Afrobeat. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we turn to history in the making in Chile, where the draft of a new constitution was presented this week that could replace the one implemented during the dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet. The president of Chile's constitutional convention, Maria Elisa Canteros, presented the draft of Chile's new constitution during a ceremony Monday.
Cabe destacar que el texto que hemos construido entre todas y todos.
It should be noted that the text we have built together emphasizes the autonomy of territories outside the center of Chile and has been the yearning of millions of Chileans.
En el centro del país. En la que subyace el espíritu del nuevo Chile.
This draft captures the spirit of a new Chile, a Chile that, on the foundation of decades of efforts, is taking a step into the future. These are the wishes of millions of citizens who place their dreams and hopes in this process. This text materializes a new way of treating one another, a new way of understanding life in our country, where everyone can feel protected.
The new constitution would recognize for the first time Chile's indigenous peoples, codify reproductive rights, make higher education free, require gender equality in the government, and require it to mitigate and adapt to the climate catastrophe. Not included in the draft were plans to nationalize parts of the country's mining industry. Work on the final version of the draft is underway. Chileans are set to vote on it September 4th. Some recent polls show fewer than 40% currently say they would vote yes. For more, we go to Santiago, Chile, and we're joined by Pablo Abufon, member of Chile's Solidaridad Movement, an English solidarity movement, an anti-capitalist feminist organization. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Pablo. Talk about the significance of what took place this week.
Hi, Amy. Good to be here. Well, the first thing to say is that this finally ends with the neoliberal constitution imposed by the dictatorship. This is very important. It has been a demand of social movements, of the civil society in Chile for decades. And this is probably a new step in a political crisis that began in October 2019, where we had a huge popular revolt in Santiago, but in other big cities and urban and rural centers in Chile, when we had millions of people taking to the streets to demand the guarantee of social rights and end to neoliberal policies like privatization of education, healthcare, and pension systems, and also gender equality and recognition of indigenous people's rights. And so this new constitution, the draft of the new constitution, is finally a place where all those aspirations have a space, have are recognized. And this is also very relevant because it's the first constitution that is democratically written. It was an elected body that is actually representative of a Chilean diversity, including gender parity, representative of indigenous peoples, of social movements like environmentalist groups and feminist movements. And so we have a body that is actually democratic. That is a huge contrast with previous constitutions that were written in the case of the dictatorship by a small group of partisan followers of the dictatorship, but also in the past that was written by a small group of experts, politicians, lawyers, etc. And so this is a completely historical milestone for our recent history.
Pablo, could you talk about what you know of how much support the draft constitution has? Well, we just mentioned that at the moment, only 40% of people in Chile say that they would vote in favor of it.
Yeah, we have to say that the same polls that say that are the polls that said that people were not approving the change of the constitution, or the people who said that the fascist, neo-fascist right-wing candidate Kast was going to win the election, and it was Gabriel Boric, a progressive, who won. So there's not too much to find in those polls, but a lot of the aspirations of the great losers of this process, of this political crisis, the conservative nationalists and defenders of the neoliberal model. So the actual references that we have, is not just the polls, but we have an 80% vote for a new constitution. We have a majority vote for representatives of social movements, of independents and leftist groups in the civil society to change a neoliberal constitution. And then we have a massive turnout to vote for Gabriel Boric as the president, as a progressive president against the fascist right-wing candidate. So those are the actual facts that we have. The rest are polls that, of course, tend to be tend to talk more about the aspirations of the people who commissioned those polls than the actual opinion of the people.
And Pablo, what about this, the fact that one of the provisions was excluded, Article 27, which would have nationalized the mining industry? If you could talk about the significance of that, and in particular, lithium and the significance, the importance of lithium to the economy in Chile, and what that had to do with this decision.
Well, Chile is an economy that is based on the extraction of raw materials. And mining is the main activity in terms of extraction of copper, and now lithium has become the new thing. And so the dispute around who can whether the state can have an economic activity in terms of extraction of lithium or just private companies, mostly multinational corporations that are currently mining a lot of the Chilean minerals right now. That's one of the main disputes, and it mobilized a lot of support. And there was actually a popular initiative bill for the Constitutional Convention that was proposing the nationalization of the mines and other natural resources. I think that we have to take into account that a constitution is not going to solve all the problems. There are still a lot of things that are going to be part of future struggles, and the constitution opens a new political period for those struggles. So it definitely, the constitution is not enshrining nationalization, but nationalization of natural resources as a way to solve an economic crisis that is ongoing. It's definite, and to pay for the social rights that are being enshrined in the constitution, it's definitely on the table, and it's going to be a part of a political struggle in the next decades, probably.
And what are the plans to galvanize support? I mean, this is going to be a referendum all over the country in September for this constitution, and how much do you expect it will change?
Well, the thing is that since the beginning of the Constitutional Convention, the right wing and the great losers of that election have been doing a dirty campaign of fake news and promoting rejection of the new constitution, even before it was written or even before we could see any of the articles. So they have a lot of advantage in that sense. They've been doing it for a long time, and now popular social movements and civil society is mobilizing for an approval of the new constitution. And now we're seeing that with the draft in our hands, we're going to go to the streets to talk to people and communicate the actual changes. I think that those polls reflect the control that the mainstream media have on the political narrative in Chile. We see that they have been talking most of the information that is on social media and mainstream media is fake news. And now we're going to see what people think about the actual constitution, the enshrining of social rights, of reproductive rights, of gender parity, of democratic process,
well,
etc.
We have to leave it there. We thank you so much, Pablo Obafon, member of Chile's Solidaridad movement, anti-capitalist feminist group. We will post the Spanish conversation at democracynow.org. Happy birthday to Eli Putnam and Samin Farkandeh. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermin Sheikh.